You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Alan Young. The Syrian Civil War, which began over a decade ago during the Arab Spring, has devastated millions of lives with brutal crackdowns, the fall of cities like Aleppo, and atrocities that have shocked the global community. Now, with the sudden collapse of the Syrian dictatorship, the country is at a pivotal crossroads. This moment brings both hope and uncertainty. Here in California, we're watching these developments with questions about the new leadership and what it means for Syria's future. Here to help us unpack the roots of this conflict and the journey ahead for the people of Syria is Dr. Keith David Wattenpah. Dr. Wattenpah is a professor of human rights studies at UC Davis and an expert on humanitarianism and the Middle East. He's lived in Aleppo and spent years working with and helping Syrian refugees and students from across the globe. Dr. Wattenpah, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Alan. It's wonderful to be here.
The Syrian civil war began during the Arab Spring, as many will remember, well over a decade ago, with demonstrations met by brutal crackdowns. Can you catch us up to today and briefly outline the factors that led to that initial violence?
Sure. In 2011, Syria underwent a Arab Spring moment following the events of Tunis and Egypt, where people, Arabs, went into the street to protest years and years of authoritarian rule. And Syria was no different. Syria to that point had been ruled by almost 50 years by the Assad family, an authoritarian Ba'athist state that denied to people their basic human rights. And these protests were peaceful. These were people who, young people, who went out on the street, carried banners, and just asked for the same basic freedoms that other people had around the world, and indeed, really for the freedoms that were guaranteed to them under the Syrian constitution. And the regime responded with the most extraordinary violence imaginable, and it set off this over decade of civil war. And it's important to remember this regime is responsible for the deaths of over 200,000 Syrians. That in the process of prosecuting its war, it used heavy weapons and barrel bombs and chemical weapons against its own people. It destroyed and attacked medical facilities and destroyed higher education and left in ruins any bit of Syrian civil society. And, you know, we have the numbers. I mean, that maybe 160,000 people have been forcibly disappeared by the regime. And we're beginning to see as people, the rebels and others have taken back Syria and opened the prisons, we're learning about the people who have survived and the people who were murdered by the regime.
And what are we finding out about just how bad things got?
I think things were worse than we imagined. In 2019, there was a very important report that Amnesty International put out that at the time really painted an incredible picture of a kind of like a slaughterhouse where Syrians would just be randomly picked up by the regime off the street and then disappeared into prisons and then murdered. And so what we're really beginning to find is that most people who were what we call forcibly displaced by the regime were murdered. There's well over 150,000 people in this condition. Just for your listeners that may follow sort of broader human rights history, the dirty wars in Argentina, 20 plus years, maybe accounted for 30,000 disappeared deaths. So this is really an unprecedented number in the history of this kind of human rights abuse.
That's incredible. Just the amount of devastation. Bringing us up to current day, the speed of the Syrian government's collapse caught many by surprise. But what were the signs that the regime was as hollow as it now appears to?
And I think that word hollow is really important. The regime was hollow, and it just, in many ways, it just took a stiff breeze to overthrow that regime. The regime was dependent upon outside support, Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, a Lebanese militia organization, which has been destroyed by the Israeli military over the last 2 months. It required this outside assistance in order to maintain power in Syria. And once Hezbollah was destroyed, Iran has sort of retreated somewhat from the global stage. And of course, Russia is fighting a war in the Ukraine, which is costing it thousands of men a week. That support was no longer there. And so when Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the Syrian Salvation Front, which is an Islamist organization, Islamist militia and government, headquartered in the Syrian city of Idlib, moved against the city of Aleppo, the regime, there was no one there to stop them. And so, a week and a half ago, I first contacted Cap Radio and said something important is happening, and that was the fall of Aleppo. And between that first conversation last week and a couple days ago, the regime collapsed, and Bashar al-Assad, the son of the president of Syria who seized power in 1970, fled to Moscow, and many high-ranking officials from his government have sought refuge elsewhere or have tried to disappear into the Syrian countryside or into Lebanon.
Let's get more into that fall of Aleppo, because you lived in Aleppo for several years and mm-hmm. continued working with refugee communities after the war has began. How did your experiences from that time come to shape your understanding of what the fall of Aleppo meant for the region and for its people?
Well, a couple things. One, Aleppo is the largest city in Syria. It was an important commercial hub. But I think more importantly, my time in Syria in the 1990s and up to last time I was there before the war was 2005, really helped me understand that Syria, like most of the countries of the Middle East, are complex, are diverse, that there's a middle class, that there are that the young people, and that these countries are overwhelmingly young, are really committed to building their own future through higher education and other resources. So when the Syrian civil war began, we at UC Davis, we responded, our human rights studies program in collaboration with UC Davis Global Affairs, we really pioneered an effort to try to address, understand and address the needs of refugees who had been university students in their homelands and now in exile were trying to continue their education. And what was important to us in that process was that we knew that we had to help these young people because they would be in a position, if they so chose, after the conflict was over, to go home and rebuild. And what's been really, I think, important is that over the last few days, my students and I have been able to talk with many Syrian refugees outside of Syria who were some of these students that we first helped. You know, some of them we first met in 2013 and 2014 when the war was started and they were in their early 20s and now they're in their 30s. And the conversations we've had with them really help us understand the reaction that Syrians outside of Syria are having to this turn of event, but also more broadly, help us understand what some of the next steps might be in Syria going forward.
What specifically have you heard from them?
So I just wanted to highlight a conversation we had with three. A young woman named, I'll just use her initial E, who is one of the smartest people I've ever met. She, during the first days of the war, her little village, Daraya, near Damascus, was besieged by the Islamic State, and under siege, she taught herself English and then fled to Beirut, where she received a scholarship to attend the American University, has now become a computer scientist and has multiple jobs, and she's doing very well. And she expressed to us concerns, in particular, about the possible extremism of the interim government that's taking shape, not just in terms of the treatment of non-practicing or sort of less fervently practicing Sunni Muslims, but also non-Muslims, and also her, I think, very legitimate concerns about whether or not she as a woman will be able to continue to not only have access to education, but also be able to be a professional in her field. We also talked to a young man, not as young anymore, but when we first met him, he was in his 20s and now he's in his mid-30s, named S, who is from Aleppo, who had been one of the student demonstrators back in the early part of the uprising and who had lost many friends to the Syrian secret police. And his concerns are really about a transition to a new Syria that's based on rights and a constitution. And also his real hope is that they'll be able to engage in a justice process where those who are responsible for the human rights abuses in Syria will be held accountable. He's also is concerned about the degree to which the group that has taken over, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or the Syrian Salvation Front, really represents an Islamist approach to the future of Syria. And then the final person we spoke to at the time of the first uprising, or this Arab Spring uprising in 2012, he was a lawyer. He just finished his law degree and was looking forward to starting to practice in the city of Aleppo. But with the war, he had to flee. And I think he represents another group of Syrian young people who, with the elapse of time, have set down roots outside of Syria, and that may not ever go back. These other two I talked about, I think that going back is something that they're thinking about, but whether or not they go back will depend upon whether or not the country itself is able to establish security and safety and stability, but also if there's going to be opportunities for them. That's, in many ways, I think that's something that we, looking at Syria from the outside, need to think about, which is, will Syria be in a position over the next few months, few years, for people like these young refugees who have left the country, received Western-style education, who have become used to certain kinds of freedoms that we have, if they're going to be willing to go back? Because ultimately, the future success of Syria depends on whether or not people like them return.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with UC Davis professor Dr. Keith David Wattenpah, an expert on Middle East humanitarianism, about the end of the 13-year civil war in Syria. Professor, the new Syrian leadership led by HTS is presenting itself as pragmatic and moderate, but given that HTS has roots with Al-Qaeda and ISIS before disavowing them, how credible do you find their efforts to be moderate, and what should we be watching for moving forward?
So they are saying and doing many of the right things. We're hearing from, just like I was talking about with the young people we're talking to, that there is a kind of wait-and-see attitude that many Syrians are taking, that this group, the new prime minister, Mohammed al-Bashir, and the the head of the militia, Ahmed al-Shara, used to be called Jawlani. I mean, they ran a province in Syria, Idlib, and they did a pretty good job by all accounts. But of course, the regime of Bashar al-Assad set a very low bar. So, I mean, people right now want safety, security, they want the water to flow, and they want the electricity to come to their houses. But there are certain tests that this new regime will have to face very shortly in the next few months, including in March, whether or not they'll be able to begin to transition to establishing a constituent assembly or beginnings of elections. And that will really be one of the initial tests of whether or not they are committed to a pluralistic, democratic, and free Syria.
Let's talk about what that could mean. I was struck by the personal story of the woman that you called E and her questions about where life could go for people like her. What could the new leadership mean for the rights of women, ethnic minorities, and religious groups?
So that's a really great question. So Syrians, and this is even before and during the regime of the Assads, Syrians tended to be a fairly tolerant people whose focus on the role of religion is that it's much more of a personal part of their lives, and that they tend to recognize that diversity exists within their society, and it's something that your job in life is not to correct others, but to try to get along with them. So it's a society that doesn't really have the kind of tradition of extremism that we've seen in Iran or in Afghanistan. And indeed, I think most Syrians would really reject any effort to impose a more strict sort of Islamist view on their society. That said, the HTS has its origins in an Islamist ideology. So that's one of my concerns. I think other concerns that I have going forward have to do with, for example, intervention by external powers, in particular Israel and Turkey, who I think are using this moment in a way to foster their own interests without being really committed to trying to secure Syria with a joint a vision of a Syria that could be stable and secure, but also a good neighbor to both of those states. And I'm especially concerned about Turkish support for a very violent militia in the north that is currently at war with the United States Kurdish pro-democracy allies. And, you know, this is a moment where I think if the United States is interested in doing something, that the something that they could do is to try to encourage countries in the region to lessen the pressure that they're bringing to bear on Syria itself and to collectively collaborate around securing its borders, protecting it from the Islamic State and other forms of terrorism, and really beginning to bring money and resources and facilitating the return of refugees.
Well, let's dive into that. What should the U.S. response be to help Syrians rebuild and shape their future? What does that actually look like?
So what it looks like is that the United States should follow the lead of the Syrians in what we can do. But also, I think we have a real role to play in putting pressure on some of our regional allies, Israel and Turkey in particular, to make sure that their presence in Syria is positive and not just a manifestation of their narrow interests. I think the United States, the U.S. is home now to a very large number of Syrians, but many Syrian professionals and others. And I think there is an opportunity going forward for the United States to support Syrians in the United States who are interested in helping with the rebuilding of their homeland.
And what would that look like? How does one or a government support our Syrians living domestically?
So one of the ways that we could do that, for example, is increasing our educational exchanges with Syria. I think that would be one area. The other would be to explore kinds of joint investment. I know that the Syrians really need capital to rebuild their country, and that this is one of the things that I know Syrians within the United States are really eager to open businesses and to begin trade with Syria. I think we could also help in helping Syrians who are interested in the documentation of human rights abuses, bring expertise to bear on that. And we could also, I think, collaborate in the pursuit of justice by helping with investigations, forensic work. But we really need to, this is a moment where Syrians, I think, want the rest of the world to take a big step back, and that they'd been in many ways the playground for Russia, Iran, the United States, Turkey, and Israel and other Arab states for so long that I think they see very little value in continuing to be a place with such limited sovereignty that other states can operate with impunity within their borders.
Just in our last 30 seconds, that's all we mm-hmm. have. But after so many years of war, what gives you hope about Syria's future?
So what gives me hope is what has always given me hope, which are the young people that I've been able to work with who have fled Syria, who are so committed to their families, to their country, and who are committed to their studies, that I see them as the best and the brightest. And if Syria can make a space for them to return, then Syria will flourish.
Dr. Wattenpah, your optimism makes the rest of us optimistic ourselves.
All right. Thank you.
UC Davis professor Dr. Keith David Wattenpah is an expert on Middle Eastern affairs and humanitarianism. Coming up next, we're going to revisit my conversation with Sacramento chef Anthony Vo, who became a star this year on Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Alan Young. We're back in just a moment.